Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. I got a question from a listener that I thought was really interesting.
Hi, Maiken. This is Scott Armato.
And here's what Scott wanted to know.
I was watching the squirrels outside my house, and it dawned on me that they were playing. Dogs and cats play. Horses, elephants. How about lizards? Birds? Bees? Why do we play?
It's a good question, right? I mean, I never really thought about why animals play and which ones do it. So we started to look around for some answers.
Would you believe octopuses play?
That is play researcher Kathy Hirsch-Pasek.
Something about that. Play is everywhere.
I do remember when my kids were born, I was surprised how soon they started to play. They were just tiny babies, but they would get the idea of simple games like peekaboo, and they would play along. I started looking around in my old videos, and I found one where my son is about a year old, and I'm asking him to imitate a peacock. I don't remember why. We probably saw one at the zoo. I'm speaking German with him, and when I say, "How does the peacock go?" he's making a silly noise because he realizes it's making me laugh.
Wie macht der Pfau? Du. Wie macht der Pfau?
Even just hearing this makes me feel happy, but it doesn't answer the question, why do we do this? Why do we play?
Maybe it's one of those behaviors that we are evolutionarily prepared to do.
Another play researcher, Gary Chick, agrees with Kathy. He thinks we are hardwired to play.
We have in fact bred ourselves to be playful, so that we like other people who are playful. And we like them more than people who are not playful.
Play is connected to brain development, to learning, to emotional well-being. There are lots of ways to play. Social play, playing with toys, dramatic, physical, rough and tumble kind of play. And also, there are lots of definitions. Here's how Kathy defines it.
Generally, we believe that it has to be something where you're active, not passive, where you're engaged, joyful, it's iterative, that means you keep on trying and keep on trying, and often, though not always, it's socially interactive.
On today's episode, we'll explore play in different settings, why we play, who plays, and how. Our first story gets into the importance of play, even for adults, and it's told by somebody who says she doesn't know how to play, our own Liz Tung. We sent her out to see if play is something you can relearn.
So here's why I say I don't play. Everyone I know has their thing. Video games, soccer, game nights with friends. Everyone except for me. I've always been kind of an indoor kid. I'm not good at sports. I never got into video games, and I'm not super craftsy. So what exactly am I doing with my free time?
For fun and relaxation.
That's my husband, Wooly. For the record, he enjoys tinkering, playing music, and doing the occasional jigsaw puzzle, though not with me.
When we do jigsaws together, I tend to be able to find the pieces and put them in the right places, and you just get annoyed because I'm putting pieces in and you can't find any.
Anyway, I asked Wooly how he sees the unwinding on a daily basis.
I think a lot of the time for fun, you either browse Reddit, watch X-Files, or go window shopping on Amazon and other sites, or look at sofas.
This is sadly true. Which is not to say I haven't tried other things. When I first started reading about how important play is, I actually Googled, how do you play as an adult? And I tried some of the suggestions. I jumped rope.
See if I can do a double swing.
I got a coloring book and crayons. I went back to some of the computer games I liked as a kid.
I just lost all my rings. Oh, man. I used to be so good at this.
For the most part, it just felt like a chore. Which got me wondering, is this something I could change? Is it something I should change? To answer those questions, I turned to the undisputed king of play research, Stuart Brown. And I told him, I don't think I know how to play.
That's too bad. Well, maybe we can remedy that.
Stuart's in his 80s now, and he's been studying play in some form or other for about 50 years. The story of how he first got interested in this research is actually pretty dark. It all started back in 1966 with a grisly shooting at the University of Texas.
One of history's worst mass murders occurred here in Austin today.
The killer was a 25-year-old veteran named Charles Whitman, who that day climbed to the top of a tower and shot dozens of people, sniper style, killing 14. It was one of America's first big mass shootings. And what made it even scarier was that Whitman was well-liked and had no known history of criminal violence. So the state of Texas put together a commission of doctors and researchers to find out what went wrong. Back then, Stuart was a young doctor, also a psychiatrist and clinical researcher who had experience with violent offenders. So they recruited him to help the commission figure out what had happened.
Why this young man, without a record of violence, had perpetrated this horrible crime?
They ended up doing a really deep dive. They interviewed Whitman's family and friends, and the conclusion they came to
was that a highly disturbed, omnipresent father had suppressed from the beginning of his life all efforts on Whitman's part to play.
Today, Stuart says there were probably other factors going on, but he was so taken with this idea that he ended up dedicating the next 50-plus years of his life to studying play. And what he concluded was that play isn't just a thing that we do.
It's a kind of a state of being in which you're engaged in an activity for its own sake. It produces a sense of usually of joyfulness or fulfillment, and it takes you out of a sense of self or time.
Stuart says his research has taught him that this state of being, this engagement, is a lot deeper than most people think.
And you begin to see that this natural phenomenon of play is deeply embedded in nature. It's there. And it's definable, and it's a different state from all others. It's as different biologically, from my standpoint, from normal consciousness as sleep and dreams are, also from normal consciousness. It's just different.
And like sleep, research has shown that play offers some important benefits. As children, it helps us develop physically and mentally. It nurtures creativity, improves our social skills, builds up confidence, and hones plenty of other important skills. But what about for adults? According to Stuart, play still occupies a crucial role after we grow up.
I think the first thing you get is a sense of lightening of mood. You know, what you're doing engages you. If it's true play, it's done for its own sake. We get more optimistic about life. We are open to making new connections in seeking out novelty.
Going without it, by contrast, can be bad news for your emotional health.
What you see is a kind of a smoldering depression.
You lose the ability to enjoy things, find the smaller pleasures in life. Stuart explores all of this in a book he published about 10 years ago called Play: How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul.
The book is about why human beings play. Like, why did we evolve to play?
That's Charlie Hone. He's an author, filmmaker, and marketing strategist. And he says he first stumbled across Stuart's book during a tough time in his life.
So play is this essential ingredient in life that's just as important as sleep. And I learned that from the book. And I started laughing when I was reading the book because I realized, oh my God, I've been depriving myself of play for years.
Back then, Charlie was in his mid-20s and burning the candle at both ends. His career was on the fast track, but the constant work, stress, and anxiety was burning him out. His hands started to shake. He had panic attacks, and his heart felt like it was beating out of his chest.
It felt like I was very sick, in that I was either going crazy or that I was dying.
It got so serious that Charlie eventually ended up quitting his job to focus on trying to get his health back. Months went by, and nothing seemed to be working, until he came across Stuart Brown's book and had this revelation.
Maybe this is what I need to do. Maybe I just need to allow myself to play.
So the next time someone contacted Charlie for a coffee meeting, Charlie suggested, hey, why don't we go to the park and play catch instead? And the guy's like, sure, sounds like a blast. So they do.
And when I came back and started working again, I noticed this sensation in my body that I hadn't felt in years, which was joy and lightness. And my work came easily. I was more able to get things done quicker.
That was enough to convince Charlie that he was on the right track. He signed up for a couple team sports. He even started an improv class. And he says for him, it was like a kind of active meditation, a way for him to go with the flow and enjoy it instead of trying to control everything around him. Today, Charlie helps other people go through that process. And he says the first step is looking at your play history. That's an idea he got from Stuart Brown, who's taken the play histories of countless patients over the years. And Stuart says it's a pretty in-depth process.
For example, show me the pictures of yourself when you were an infant. What do you see? What's your natural tendency? Do you like visual things, auditory things, tactile? Can you remember? What were you told your initial temperament and personality were like?
Answering those questions was my first assignment in my mission to rediscover play. So to do that, I decided to go straight to the source.
Hello.
Hello.
I was just texting.
My parents.
It's soupy out there.
We started with my baby album.
Okay. And what do I look like as a baby?
You have a really big head. And kind of a ruddy complexion.
We're leafing through pictures, which cover birth up until I'm 3 or 4. And according to my parents, my predilection for sitting on my ass goes all the way back to the beginning.
You were very placid. In fact, you would fall asleep while you were feeding, and I would have to kind of flick the bottom of your feet with my fingers to get you more alert.
But when I got old enough to start playing, my parents said I had a very specific focus.
So that, I think that's what I remember most about your preschool play years, is that there was a lot of pretend and there was a lot of imagination.
My sister and I had a stuffed animal family, the Randabucks, the whole backstory and little houses we'd built in our closets. As we got older, that creative energy evolved into something more like improv.
It was like you were always writing, extemporizing skits with each other, with these sort of imaginary characters. And so that dialogue would go on and on and on and on.
According to my parents, I also had a fondness for doing impersonations. Bill Clinton was my specialty. And for dressing our cat up in costume jewelry. They said the common thread was improvisation, silliness, whimsy.
And what you didn't do was play much with toys. You weren't indifferent, but you weren't fascinated either.
Which kind of explains why my adult attempts at playing mostly fell flat. Puzzles, jump rope, coloring books just wasn't my thing, because I never really liked doing that stuff. What I did like was storytelling, pretend, forcing my parents to listen while I read from an old joke book from the 1950s. The question is, how does that impulse translate into adult play? For one thing, according to longtime play researcher Gary Chick, play doesn't have to involve other people.
No, it does not have to be social.
What it does need to be is fun, engaging, and not performed for any other purpose other than your own enjoyment. Which, when I think about it, is kind of what I do for my job. Of course, I do the work because it's work, because I need a paycheck at the end of the day. But all this reflecting made me think, could it be that, in a way, my job counts as play? It seemed totally counterintuitive. But if you ask Gary, it isn't. At least, not necessarily. I asked him what he does for play, He's retired now, but this is what he said.
Mostly what I do, and this may sound awful, but I get a kick out of doing research. That's my play. And seriously, and I play this, you know, people are really going to think, what kind of a lunatic is this guy doing statistics and computer programming? I find to be playful.
I was encouraged by that, because that means I don't need to stress myself out rediscovering how to play. It's already a part of my life. I just had to rethink what exactly play meant for me. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
That was Liz Tung on her quest to rediscover how to play. Play is important to humans. That's the big takeaway point from Liz's story, right? And when you look at kids, it seems like play comes totally naturally to them. They can create entire worlds with next to nothing. A cardboard box becomes a ship, a carpet, an ocean. It's fun to watch, but what exactly is play doing for them, for their brains? How does play foster development during different stages of childhood? Reporter Melanie Peoples looked into this and has this story.
Guys, come here! Okay.
A little girl named Ellie and her grandmother are playing together after snack time. This is a game of make-believe, where a character named Luna Girl has turned the world outside unbearably hot.
Luna goes outside in the hot.
Okay, go for it! Get her! Did you get her? Did you get her?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
No. Turns out that didn't work. Ellie can still see Luna Girl.
Dale.
Oh my gosh, I see her. What are you going to do?
Ha. I know what I'm going to do. Maybe the window will help.
That's it! Is it working?
The wind blew her away without her Luna board. Yes! Give me five! Woo!
So let's look at play a little bit differently.
This grandmother isn't just any grandmother. She's Kathy Hirsch Pasek, a professor of psychology at Temple University in Philadelphia, and one of the leading experts on the importance of play.
It's not just frivolous. It's not just joyful. It actually is a vehicle for achieving pretty powerful learning.
The building blocks of intelligence and social development for the entire human race, you could say. For starters, learning to get along with others.
She had to get along with my character. And together, we had to fight against the bad. Now, the good and bad stuff is very paganistic. But boy, does it work with little kids. And in a sense, it's building their own sense of morality.
And then, when Ellie introduced the concept of wind, she showed some pretty important flexible problem-solving skills.
That was her idea. There she knew the properties of wind had cooling properties. So she's a little scientist working together with someone else to solve a very real problem.
Ellie is 4, and there's a lot going on at this magical age where children really start to master the art of working together. Before this point, a lot of what toddlers do is called parallel play.
So it occurs side by side, and you kind of know they're there, but not really.
You're just doing your thing. You might fight over a train or a truck, and then go back to ignoring each other. And before parallel play, we can go even younger. What's the first thing you put in his hands? A rattle or a toy. And a baby knows exactly what to do with it.
Oh, it's their biological nature to play.
Bill Klim is a professor of neuroscience at Texas A&M University.
It's actually nature's way of training the brain in a age-appropriate developmental way.
And it's reward-based. When we're playing, our brains get an extra dose of dopamine, the chemical that makes us feel good. So we do it again and again, which is a really brilliant system to reward learning. The thing we must do in order to survive as a species. So what would happen if we didn't play? Since no one would ever do this kind of experimenting with humans, scientists turned to animals to test this theory, like rats, an animal I don't normally think of as playing.
Well, that's because you're not around rats very often, I bet. But I am. I do studies on rats, and I've seen them play.
When researchers kept rats from playing with other rats, rats were less able to solve mental tasks. They became anxious and couldn't interact properly with other rats. Would that happen with humans if they didn't play?
Well, it'd be a similar sort of thing. They would be probably have anxiety, maybe prone to depression. They certainly wouldn't interact socially in expected ways, in ways that other people would expect them to.
It turns out play is so important because in order to grow, our brains need a specific type of stimulation.
A lot of neurotransmitter systems get altered if they're not activated in normal ways.
But when those parts of the brain are activated in normal ways, like by playing, the brain grows. Well, not in actual, like, size, but inside the brain, with an increased number of synapses and an increased efficiency in those synapses. In other words, when we play, the brain is learning how to learn. Which is why Bill says that when we let kids play more and more with electronic screens, the human race is already involved in a science experiment.
And I have some concerns about our society. We, in the age of electronics, instead of playing with each other, play with their gizmos. And maybe they're not learning how to interact with people as much as kids in older generations.
Bill worries that even organized play, like baseball and football, may not offer enough of the kind of creative play our species has had historically. Unfortunately, it'll be years before scientists know what the effect, if any, of playtime versus screen time has been.
That was Melanie Peoples reporting. So far, we've focused on humans, but other animals play too. We know what that looks like with pets like cats or dogs. One of our listeners, Christine, sent us a video of her dog, Nelson. She's spraying the garden hose at him, and he's biting the water. I think the audio gives you an idea of what's happening. When she stops spraying, he barks as if to say, "Spray me again, spray me again." But what about other animals? Animals that don't seem to express their emotions to us as clearly as our pet mammals. How do you think about the internal lives of, say, birds or spiders? What counts as play for them? Alan Yu looked into this.
Today is a big day in the life of Mo, a black-headed caique. He's a small parrot, not as big as a pigeon, with green wings, a white belly, and a black and yellow head. Mo has lots of space. He lives by himself inside a large cage at the Brandywine Zoo in Wilmington, Delaware. And today he's going to get a lot of new toys.
So bells are one of Mo's favorite toys. And he's actually got one in here already, but we're going to give him all of the bells that I could find. He's going to have bell overload.
That's lead animal keeper Caitlin Muse.
So this is a new toy for him. It's basically just like a wicker tunnel. So anything that's new can be a little scary for any animal.
Once Caitlin's done putting in all the new toys, she hides small bits of food all around and steps out.
Seems like he's going to be distracted by food and not play with his bells. He's being very brave though. You're going into your tunnel, bud. Good job.
Mo crawls inside the wicker tunnel and finds the tiny kernels of corn inside. This is entertaining to watch, but why would the zookeepers put so much effort into keeping a small parrot entertained?
So we give them things that are going to encourage natural behaviors. So for these guys, they would be foraging a lot, constantly looking for food. So we find places to hide their food, spread their food out so it takes more time to eat their food, just so it's not always presented in like a bowl.
This is called enrichment, a kind of play, and it's important work for zoos. Here's assistant curator Mandy Fisher.
There's some species where play is very important. So a lot of our primate species, for baby animals in particular, play is how they learn some of those life skills that they'll need for hunting or for breeding behaviors or caring for young can all be done through play. Some of our animals, though, it is purely exercise. They are, you know, built for speed or built for strength. Or they're hunters, and so we can use those natural behaviors and design enrichment that will allow that to show.
Play is about learning for some animals and a workout for others. So do all animals play? If you want to study that, you have to think about play from an animal's point of view, says psychologist Gordon Burkhardt.
It wasn't that many years ago, several decades ago, that it was thought that birds didn't play.
Of course, we know at least one bird who would disagree.
It's our sort of biases, I think, that inhibited us from looking at other animals from a less anthropomorphic viewpoint and see that something like play is really deeply embedded into our biological roots, our evolutionary heritage.
Gordon has become one of the experts on animal play. He recently came up with a more rigorous definition of play to try and break free of the limits of our human-centered perspective. To make it very simple, he says something counts as play for an animal if they do it voluntarily over and over again, only when they're not stressed, and it's somehow different than a more serious version of that behavior.
It's not serious fighting, for instance, if you see animals play wrestling.
One particular type of spider will actually play at having sex when they're not mature yet. It's play and not real sex, because the females are far less likely to eat the males afterwards. When animals don't have opportunities to play, it can have serious consequences. Gordon says, think about how zoos used to be built. In the past, zoos were very sterile. The design philosophy was all about making it easy for humans to clean.
Lions might be in a tile, concrete, type of enclosure that could be hosed down every day, and there was virtually nothing in it, of course, that would hinder efficient cleaning. Well, that might have made the animal's housing more sterile, but also completely uninteresting, and would have psychological consequences, similar to keeping people in jail cells versus in a richer environment.
Bored, caged animals can develop tics, like pacing, or bar biting. Another good example of this, ravens.
Some of the enclosures that we're walking by, we have a 50-foot flight cage.
Rebecca Michelin is the director of wildlife rehabilitation at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. She nurses injured wild animals back to health before release. In a previous job, she worked with a lot of ravens, and she says that while ravens are healing, they still need stimulation.
Keeping them entertained is really challenging because they're so intelligent that they need changes to their environment on a regular basis. They need mental challenges to keep them entertained and keep them busy. Otherwise, they'll actually start self-harming out of boredom and unhappiness.
Rebecca says bored and stressed out ravens will peck at their own feathers or even beat their wings against the side of a cage so hard that they can become seriously injured. Boredom is an important issue for research animals too. Mice and rats in labs have to live in enclosed spaces, and researchers take care to give them tubes to crawl inside and sticks to chew on. Tara Martin is a veterinarian at the University of Michigan. She says if research animals are bored and stressed, that's bad for the animals, but it's also bad for science.
An animal that lives in a barren environment is a pretty stressed animal. It can affect hormones within their body, it can affect their immune system, it can certainly affect brain development. And when you have all of those effects, they all can act as confounds on your research, or they can alter the results of your research.
That story was reported by Alan Yu, and we asked all of you to share your favorite stories about animals playing. We heard from Valentina, who told us about a horse she used to care for, Lucky. She says they played tag.
He'd walk next to me, and then all of a sudden I'd start running, and he would run after me,
and then he'd bump his nose into my back. And when I stopped, he'd just start slowly walking away till I caught him again. And then I started running again, and this went back and forth for a while, and we just had great fun with that.
And here's another one we got.
Hi, my name's Shannon Patrick. I'm the owner of the Puppy Palace Doggy Daycare in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
The dogs play in little baby pools. They have lots of toys.
But probably the favorite activity of the day would be the bubbles, because they love to jump in the air like crazy monkeys.
Thank you for sending these. We love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, look for WHYY The Pulse, or follow me on Twitter at Mike and Scott. You're listening to The Pulse. We're talking about play. Now, back to humans. Games are often tryouts for human interactions. You learn how to lose with grace, how to strategize, how to read other people. There's a really popular card game called Werewolf. It's also known as Mafia, and it traces its roots to the psychology department of Moscow State University, where it was developed as a way to study human behavior.
Okay, you have to point.
To who we think.
To who you think is the wolf. Oh, nice one. It is me.
Yeah! I was like, I don't trust him.
Here are the basics. There are two teams. One team is the villagers, with a bunch of supporting characters, and the other team, the werewolves. Who is whom is decided by the card you draw.
And the objective of the game is for the villagers to either eliminate all the werewolves,
or for the werewolves to kill off the villagers. Once the werewolves are exposed, or there are more werewolves than villagers, the game ends. Once the cards have been dealt, a facilitator will tell everybody to go to sleep. There's an app you can download.
Everyone, close your eyes. Werewolves, wake up and look for other werewolves.
So only the werewolves will open their eyes for a moment. Everybody else's eyes are closed, no peeking.
The werewolves then know who each other's are, so they know who they are, but the villagers do not know who the werewolves are.
Everyone, wake up.
And then the great debate begins.
This is David Eves. He is a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. In his day job, he's an expert on government and technology, but by night, he's an avid werewolf player. He's written articles about what the game can teach us about trust and collaboration. In the game, players start to ask each other questions. The wolves lie about who they are, of course, and eventually players have to vote. Who's a wolf? Who's a villager?
You begin to realize there's real method here. You have to be listening to what everybody says, watching how people are behaving, watching how they're voting, looking for tells, and you very quickly realize it's not a game of luck. There's real skill in being an effective werewolf or being an effective villager. And that you can tilt the odds in the favor of one or the other if you are a good player.
Which makes you think that they're both werewolves, and he's trying to find a way to cover for Rick and not say, well, Rick's a werewolf, because then he loses too.
Well, we're definitely not both werewolves.
Why?
Because I was not a werewolf.
That's what a werewolf would say.
When I started.
Then why didn't he turn on me?
Because you're the werewolf.
I'm not the werewolf!
It explains everything.
David first began playing werewolf at technology conferences. He says the game is really popular in that crowd.
One thing that werewolf does is it teaches you how well your friends lie. You know, some people they're just terrible werewolf players, and everybody knows they're lying. And it's kind of fun, right? You're just a terrible liar. And then other people are quite sophisticated. And so you're not really used to having your friends lie to you, especially in such a like open and upfront way. And so to have a game where now you're trying to figure out who's telling the truth and who's lying and what are the tells they have. There's a lot of fun, I think, that's in that.
But it can be a little unsettling because sometimes people have this ease with which they lie and you're like, oh, dude, what was that?
This is what makes it so much fun. You're like, the person who you thought was this, great friend, super loyal, always could be relied on, super trustworthy. And then all of a sudden, they're an amazing werewolf player and their ability to fool you. And then you go, wow, you have to revisit all your assumptions about somebody.
And what are the lessons that we take away from playing this game? Does it ultimately mean that we will trust people less because we've now witnessed how great they can lie?
I actually feel it's the opposite. There's a few things that I've taken away from Werewolf. The first one is actually you do get better at telling who's lying. it is possible to identify people, even really good liars. Over time, I have seen people, as they get more experience at the game, can tell who's lying better. And actually, as a life skill, that's probably a pretty good skill to build. So I actually take a lot of encouragement of that, that actually gets easier and easier to identify liars. The other thing that I take away from the game is people learn how to work together as a team. Like, the village really needs to work together as a team. And in order for the village to win, you actually have to be, in some ways, selfless. You have to be prepared to die, because actually your death may advance the cause of the village. And so the villagers that start to work really well together are the ones who figured out the rules and have figured out how to work together in order to defeat the werewolves.
Working together means you have to get people to talk.
And this is a common mistake that people playing werewolf often make, especially when they first play it. Everybody's silent. Nobody wants to say anything. Or worse, the village kind of jumps on whoever speaks first and immediately kills them. And the way that you win at werewolf is you actually want data. And the data that you want is people telling stories, people talking. Like, that's how the tells come out. If everybody's quiet, it's very hard to spot a tell. And it kind of reminds me of police interrogations. Like, what the police want is they want you talking a lot, because the more you talk and the more you share, the more information you have, and the more likely you might contradict something you said earlier or say something that doesn't make sense with what's going on in the game. So what you really want is to get lots and lots of data onto the table. So you want people talking, and then you, like, look for the inconsistencies in those stories. You look for, like, the slight tells, like them looking up or them looking shifty. That's what you're looking for.
David Eves is a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and he uses werewolf with his students. He says it teaches them how to cope in new and difficult situations. Coming up, when the only place to play nearby is a parking lot.
It's all concrete. All it takes is one fall, and, you know, hope for God it won't be nobody's head.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about play, why we play, and what playing does for us. Having a place to run around, get creative, and let off steam is really important for kids. But lots of them don't have places where they can play. That's especially true in cities. A survey of public elementary schools in Philadelphia showed that only 1/3 of them have playgrounds in their schoolyards. Kids at most schools play on cracked concrete and in parking lots. Nina Feldman reported on this issue and visited one schoolyard and one family in the dead of winter.
Today is the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year.
We made cookies with sprinkles. We had hot cocoa.
Mackenzie Barnes and her big brother Maurice are really excited. It's the first day of winter break.
My teacher said no homework because she wanted to get a break and you wanted to get a break. Yep, but when we come back, we still want to be in first grade.
The evening is warm for this time of year, close to 60 degrees. So even though it's already dark, Maurice and Mackenzie want to play outside.
Mackenzie, you want to play football?
Yeah.
Their mom gives the okay, and the family heads across the street to play on the lot outside Lowell Elementary, where the kids go to school.
Malia, why are you taking off your jacket? Put that jacket on, girlfriend.
Maurice and his mom play catch while Mackenzie and the littlest sister, Malia, run around nearby.
Come here, Bubba. Come here.
Malia is a toddler in the truest sense of the word. She chases her sister up and down a delivery ramp alongside the school wall, and a faceplant into the concrete seems inevitable. The kid's grandmother, Antoinette Reynolds, looks on from her usual post on the family's front porch.
If I'm not in the door, I'm usually in that window. You know, keeping an eye out on all of them, not just mine, but, you know, all the kids that go over there. You'll usually hear me yelling about, hey, no, don't do that, get off of that, don't touch that, go back in the schoolyard.
Reynolds says she worries someone will get hurt. She watches as Maurice dives for a wobbly football and takes a bad spill.
It's all concrete. All it takes is one fall. And, you know, hope for God, it won't be nobody's head.
Administrators at Lowell Elementary call this the schoolyard, but it's also the parking lot. The kids play while teachers load into their cars and head home for the evening. Reynolds says kids are always sneaking out through holes in the fence and running around the neighborhood.
So if you put a playground in there, monkey bars and things that they can climb on and play on, it'll keep them in there.
She says she doesn't remember having this problem when she was growing up.
Every school I went to, that we had a nice play area that we were able to play in.
What do you think happened?
I guess the funds.
We definitely, in leaner times, stepped away from playground projects.
That's Danielle Floyd, Chief Operating Officer at the Philadelphia School District. Her office puts out an annual budget call to ask schools what they need. About half of all elementary schools ask for playgrounds each year.
I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you. It's one of the most heavily requested items that we get from schools.
But here's the problem. The district has no dedicated budget for playground improvements. Private foundations pay for some renovations, but there's no formal process to decide who gets that help. Floyd guesses the district completes about 8 to 10 playgrounds a year with philanthropic funds. But kids in Philly need books, too. Buildings need upkeep. Teachers need to be paid. Should playgrounds really be a priority?
The answer to that is that it solves more than one problem at a time.
This is Sharon Danks, an environmental planner who advocates for green schoolyards around the country.
Our budgets are very siloed, and we think about solving the health problem or the education attainment problem or the environment problem.
Danks says schoolyards can do all of that, so we should be thinking about them more like public parks. Playgrounds are little pockets of public land scattered throughout the city. But
the infrastructure hasn't been developed with that perspective. It is our most well-used public parkland, completely undeveloped.
Kids are already using these spaces every day. And if we did develop the land by building jungle gyms, swing sets, and sports fields, kids would use it even more. Research shows kids are the most active on playground equipment and on grass, in contrast to paved areas.
What do you see happen to Maurice if he doesn't get to run around?
He's bouncing off the walls.
Antoinette Reynolds, Maurice's grandmother, tries to find a way for him to run around no matter what. She lets him play in the parking lot at night, like on that first day of break, or she gives him a ride to a nearby park if she has time. She won't have to soon enough. That's because Lowell Elementary is one of the lucky ones. It's getting a new playground, which Maurice, Mackenzie, and Malia will all be able to enjoy.
This story was reported by Nina Feldman, and it was part of a WHYY series called Uneven Play. You're listening to The Pulse. We're talking about why we play and how. Here's a game that only requires a flat surface and jump ropes, Double Dutch, where jumpers navigate two long ropes that are swinging in opposite directions.
When I double dutch, I feel free.
You have to know when to jump in.
Gives me a lot of energy and makes me expand my mind to different things.
And when you're jumping, you know, like, you try to do your best, and if somebody laughs at you, that means that they're just kind of mad that you actually tried, and I feel bravery when I jump into the rope.
Up into the middle, turn around, quiet your feet.
Reverend Malika Lee Whitney loved Double Dutch as a kid growing up in Harlem. She's in her 70s now, and she still jumps. And she runs a youth development program called Double Dutch Dreams in Harlem and all around New York City. She says jumping contributes to her overall well-being, exercising her heart, balancing her body. Recently, some of her young jumpers got to ask her about her passion for Double Dutch.
Why do you like Double Dutch so much?
Well, I love it for what I see it brings out of the young people that I work with. And I really enjoy it because I know it's a great way to exercise. And it's a wonderful way to make friends. And it gives you an opportunity to test your skills and be confident. The heart is racing. You're excited. You feel like everything is working for you, you know, the feet are moving the correct way, you're maintaining a rhythm. Very often you're being watched, somewhere, either by your friends, if it happens to be on a stage, that encourages you. So you feel good about yourself. You have a sense of accomplishment.
When you had boys on and doing double dutch, did you ever have a crush on one of them?
I was wondering when this was going to get personal. Well, one of the things that I can tell you, if you were jumping in the community, like in front of your building, you put your best jump on when you saw someone that you liked.
Raise your hand.
Why did you choose to work with youth and teach children?
I think working with children is something that I inherited from my mother, because she also not only took care of me, but she also took care of children in the neighborhood, and especially helped mothers who needed to work and needed someone to care in a loving way. There is a lot of seriousness going on in the world. And I think you can use sport and play as a means of being able to, how should I say, change the course of ideas. In Double Dutch program, one primary part of what we do is under the umbrella of social justice. So we write rhymes that address issues of racism, sexism, and all the other isms,
to obtain
human rights,
civil rights,
peace,
and justice.
So using games as an approach is a way to get young people involved, and look what it yields. Games can help, like, oh, you're doing that? I want to do it too. Oh, can you show me how? You know, cooperative learning through games is a wonderful way to help a child grow up. It invites people of all cultures, all backgrounds, all sizes. Our ropes don't discriminate. There are other ways to involve. I've worked with the deaf community, for example. And if one does have some physical limitations, we can find some kind of way that they can participate.
Come on.
Come on.
Get your jump on.
Get your jump on.
You can learn.
If the knees continue to work, I think I'll be doing it until I'm 100.
It's easy.
You can do it.
You can do it.
1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3.
Pick up your knees.
Pick up your knees.
Just follow me.
Just follow me.
Come on.
Come on.
Get your jump on.
Get your jump on. Ooh.
The story was recorded at the Sugar Hill Children's Museum of Art and Storytelling in New York City and produced by Rachel Bongiano and Clara Ibarra for the Grandparent Story Lab, an intergenerational project. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jazz Lehman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris and also Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.